UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
Nontuberculosis mycobacterial lung disease is particularly vexing for clinicians to diagnose and treat. My guest today is Dr. George Solomon. He's an assistant professor in the Division of Pulmonary Allergy and Critical Care Medicine at UAB Medicine. Dr. Solomon, what is the prevalence of nontuberculosis mycobacterial lung disease, and what do we know about this disease?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't know exactly what the prevalence of that illness is. I can tell you that the prevalence and incidence of new cases is certainly on the rise. A lot of that has to do with detection of the illness, awareness of the illness, and increasing aging of our population. But we don't have a good estimate of prevalence and incidence. It's not a common disease, so it's not a 1 in 1,000 of their population have this illness. But it's certainly not so uncommon that it's considered a significantly rare illness anymore either. And I believe that's because of the shifting demographics of our population. We're seeing more patients exposed and becoming symptomatic with the illness. So therefore, those numbers are in flux.
One thing I found interesting, Dr. Solomon, is that NTM infections, unlike tuberculosis, don't require public health reporting. Do you feel this hinders an accurate understanding of the epidemiology or may not be reflective of changes in prevalence?
It's a great question. The real reason why the infections are not reported as a public health concern, the same as other communicable infections like tuberculosis, is really the communicability of the infection. In other words, the rate at which it's passed from patient to patient. The understanding of the biology of the illness is such that most of the acquisition of the infection is from susceptible people getting it from the environment. Therefore, for it to be a public health reported illness doesn't make as much sense. That said, because we don't capture the data in a standardized fashion, the estimates of incidence and prevalence are going to be highly varied, as we've just discussed. So there's part of me says that it's the right thing to do because there are definitions of what has to be a reportable illness because of communicability. The other side to me says that if we were to make it a public health reported illness, we may have a better estimate of incidence and prevalence to understand how common it is. Now, soil samples are gathered for the amount of the organism being captured in the soil throughout the state. So we have an idea of states that have high levels of this being in the water supply and in the soil, which is the two common reservoirs for the infection, for patients to acquire them. So that we have an idea about that, but as far as the number of new cases, we are going to be limited unless we make it a reportable illness.
Dr. Solomon, you just mentioned soil and water. Where else might the bacteria be found, and what are the mechanism of infection? How does NTM affect the body, and what are some commonly encountered patterns of NTM pulmonary infections?
Great question. So let me take the first part of your question first. So the natural reservoirs, as I stated, for this infection are basically the environment, our soil and water, and especially the Deep South, and believe it or not, areas like archipelago islands like Hawaii have high amounts of these organisms in the soil and water samples. The bugs are a little bit smart in that they can lie in a dormant state, much like fungus can. And so they can live in a dormant state in these environments for a long time, requiring very little nutrient, and only become sort of active and replicating when they hit their host, which is in this case is humans. The most common infection that we encounter, those common non-tuberculous mycobacterial infection we encounter is one called Mycobacterium avium, and it exists in a complex of several species which are highly interrelated, and those organisms tend to present with an infection that tends to be an indolent infection that tends to cause cough, malaise, and low-level fevers or night sweats in the host, the human host. So the most common presentation of this illness tends to be an indolent illness with some fevers, cough, and the onset eventually of increasing pulmonary symptoms like cough and breathlessness as the most common presenting symptoms of this condition. But because of the slow nature of these infections and their infectivity, we oftentimes see that patients have had symptoms that are suggestive of this for quite some time before they either present for diagnosis or are effectively diagnosed with the condition.
Well then, Dr. Solomon, what are the diagnostic criteria? Because there are some related disorders where comparisons may be useful for a differential diagnosis, but what would even have a provider think along these lines?
Yeah, so the common circumstance in which this condition is considered tends to be the right demographics or the right host susceptibility. So let me try to explain what I mean by those two things. These infections tend to present most commonly in elderly patients, so that means patients that are in their sixth or later decades of life. Most commonly, patients infected are in the age range of 65 plus. So these are patients that are at present considered in the senior citizen age bracket. So that age bracket with the symptoms I've outlined is the circumstance in which you should most effectively think this patient may have an NTM-type infection. Now, there are other circumstances in which we encounter this very frequently, too. Patients that have known structural lung disease, those include chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, known or established bronchiectasis due to any of a number of conditions, cystic fibrosis, primary ciliary dyskinesia, any of another number of those, including immunodeficiency disorders. Those patients are also exquisitely susceptible to picking this up earlier in life. So if the condition is encountered, if those types of symptoms are encountered in a patient with a known bronchiectasis lung type disease or structural lung disease, it should be considered anywhere early, anywhere in their presentation of illness. If it's a de novo case, in other words, a patient is having these types of symptoms, it's more common to encounter it and more likely to be diagnosed in patients who are older, in their sixth or later decades of life. So those are the two patient populations to which you should think about this condition. Not to say it can't happen sporadically in other age brackets in which there aren't pre-existing conditions that make the patient susceptible, but it's most commonly encountered in those two patient buckets of grouping the patient.
Then let's talk about the standard therapies. And since it's aerosolized and aerobic, what are the standard therapies you would use, and what are some of the challenges when deciding on these therapies? Doctor, since it can be in a water heater or a shower or a spray bottle or even a hot tub, there's all kinds of places. Is there then a process for checking the area where you suspect it might be present?
That's a great question. So let me take the question of standard therapy first, and then I'll answer your question about how to deal with preventive measures for the condition. So standard therapy for this condition depends upon the particular organism in this bucket of infections we call non-tuberculous mycobacterial or NTM infections we encounter. We typically encounter most commonly, this would account for the overwhelming majority of cases, probably 80 to 90% of cases, we encounter two different species. One is the MAC complex, the Mycobacterium avium complex, we call MAI infection. Most commonly, that accounts in the U.S. for about two-thirds or greater of the cases that we encounter. And that infection, assuming there aren't complications arising from the infection like cavitary lung disease or extra pulmonary lung disease, which we don't have time to get to in the interview today, assuming it's mild lung disease, can be relatively well treated with a prolonged course of three oral antibiotics. And those usually involve, as a standard, this is set by the American Thoracic Society in correlation with the IDSA, the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Usually those two governing bodies recommend three oral antibiotics, which include a macrolide antibiotic, either clarithromycin or azithromycin, as well as the addition of two other antibiotics, which were originally developed for treating tuberculosis, including ethambutol and rifampin, or one of its derivatives. Those antibiotics, in general, are effective at treating patients if taken effectively until you reach microbiologic cure, which means successive clear cultures of the organism and improvement of symptoms and radiology, and then the patient continues those on for 12-plus months after clearance. So if that's the case, that's a fairly easily treated infection. Now, there are other organisms. The second most commonly encountered organism is one called Mycobacterium abscessus complex. And it also has several interrelated species which are treated. These require a bit more aggressive therapy. They tend to be more invasive organisms. So they require an initial period of oral plus intravenous antibiotics, followed by a prolonged period of oral plus inhalational antibiotics. So just to clarify, intravenous plus oral antibiotics for an initial period, followed by inhalational plus oral antibiotics for a prolonged period. And this is dependent on the type of organism that's encountered in that complex as to exactly which of those are encountered, are used, and for how long. So that's a good bit more complicated infection treatment regimen, but it also can be effective and has been shown to be relatively effective in some longitudinal studies which have been conducted. So that sort of answers the outlay of how we treat it. It's dependent upon what organism and then prolonged treatment to ensure sustained clearance of cultures and symptoms and radiographic appearance. Now, your other question related to, is there a way to prevent this infection from either incurring to start with or from recurring once you've acquired it? And there has been some literature looking at whether or not you should not use hot showers, for instance, because showers are known to aerosolize these infections to people with susceptible lungs. Studies have shown that in fact, not using the shower does not prevent the patient from having encounters with this. There are a couple things that I recommend to patients which are based loosely on the literature, which I think are good ideas for patients. The first of those is, if possible, minimize significant soil exposure, like significant farming, digging, gardening, if it can be removed from the patient's life without affecting their quality of life. The second is, the circumstances in which we encounter a lot of these organisms being encountered in a more epidemic type of level is in patients that visit steam showers or saunas or enclosed hot tubs. So those are the circumstances which you have a reservoir of water which is not always changed out and cleaned effectively, and it's very hot and it's being aerosolized in a very aggressive fashion to create the circumstance that's pleasing for people like at a spa or resort or whatnot. So I do tell patients that are susceptible to this or have had this infection before, if all possible, to avoid that circumstance in addition to the gardening or farming soil exposures. But those are not rooted in strong evidence for effectiveness of minimizing recurrence of infection. Really, the key to recurrence of infection is to have effective microbiologic cures outlined earlier and sustaining that with clearance. Now, the other thing that can help with patients, and this has been shown in some studies, is clearing the airways of infected material. So in addition to treating the infection with antibiotics, mechanical and medical therapies which clear infected mucus throughout the course of treatment and then beyond the course of treatment afterwards, so that if infection were to try to reestablish itself, it's removed quickly by enhanced mucus clearance therapies. Those have been shown to help reducing reinfectivity rates. So that's recommended by most practitioners that treat patients with this illness.
What an interesting topic we're discussing here today. And Dr. Solomon, in summary, tell other physicians what you'd like them to know about recognizing NTM lung disease and when you feel it's very important to refer.
Yeah. So these are my kind of hallmarks for this. If you have a patient in which you suspect mycobacterial disease, non-tuberculous mycobacterial disease, it's not one of those things that you're going to just stumble upon the answer whether they have it or not. You're going to have to go searching. So if they have susceptibilities we've outlined earlier, or they're having a constellation of symptoms in a patient that you wouldn't otherwise think is susceptible, you're going to have to get imaging and you're going to have to try to get sputum samples to try to look for this organism. Now, in certain circumstances throughout our state and throughout our country, all of that diagnostic evaluation is challenging to be able to be done in a local office. So if it can't be done, make the referral, even if you don't know the patient has the illness, even if you're just suspecting it based on a chest x-ray or a constellation of symptoms, and we can assist with the diagnosis and then immediately moving a patient into treatment as we go along. So I recommend early and often thinking about referral because this can be a very challenging illness to make the diagnosis for. And then the management of treatment for this is not trivial. It requires prolonged antibiotics, which have a lot of side effects and require a lot of patient coaching and some knowledge about how to do that. So I recommend early referral if you're considering this and don't have a significant amount of experience dealing with the antibiotics or advanced diagnostics.
Thank you so much, Dr. Solomon, for coming on with us today and discussing this really interesting topic that not everybody knows about and where it's acquired and when it's important to refer. A community physician can refer a patient to UAB Medicine by calling the MIST line at 1-800-UAB-MIST. That's 1-800-822-6478. You're listening to UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physician. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks for tuning in.